Hello, my name's Eitan Alil. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Challenger Energy Group. Challenger is a junior AIM-listed exploration and production company. We focus on the Atlantic margin. Our primary focus, and pretty much all that we're going to talk today about, is Uruguay, where we have some really exciting offshore exploration assets. But we also have a bit of history. We have a small onshore producing business in Trinidad. We have the Bahamas. But really, if you want to think about it, Challenger Energy is the only junior energy company with exposure to Uruguay.
Good to meet you, Eitan. First of all, we've better spoken, so I'm kind of intrigued to work out like who I'm dealing with and a bit of background. So can you tell us, you know, what have you done before that's kind of relative to what you're going to talk about today?
Well, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm an Australian. I started my life as a corporate lawyer in Sydney. I very quickly fell to the dark side and I became an investment banker and I worked in a large private equity investment banking shop, first in Australia and then in Asia. But fundamentally, all I ever did there was resources and energy projects, in the course of which I happened to be one of the early shareholders and founders of a company that grew and grew and grew and ultimately became a thing called Arrow Energy, which was one of the great Australian energy investment success stories. We ultimately wound up selling that company to Shell and PetroChina in 2012, which at that stage was the largest ever corporate transaction in Australia. Since then, I've done the same thing at various other companies. I was with a company called Dart Energy, which got sold to another UK company. I then joined this company. In those days, it was known as Bahamas Petroleum. We worked some assets in the Bahamas a long time. During COVID, we diversified. That's how we picked up the assets in Uruguay. That's when I became the CEO. And now we've sort of repositioned this company as purely focused on Uruguay. But so I come from a more finance, investment banking, corporate background. I'm not a geoscientist or geologist or that by that.
Okay, got it. So, look, it's been through a few, oil and gas has been through a few dark moments of recent times. And,
yes.
You know, a bright light shining back on it at the moment, which is good news. Can you just talk about the rest of the team before we get into business models and the plan? Who else is supporting you?
Well, we have a very lean team, right? I mean, it's part of the business model is to operate a lean, focused team. Have an absolutely outstanding board. Our chairman, Ian McKendrick, was... for a long time, very senior at Total. Simon Potter, our former CEO, is now non-executive director. He, for a long time, was at BP in very senior roles. Stephen Bizzle, one of our other directors, is a very well-known person in the energy, mining, resources, investment space in Australia. We have a full complement. We have a Randy Hiscock looks after all of our Uruguayan assets. He was a lifer at Shell. He's a geologist. We've got a full operating team in Trinidad. So it's a small team, but a lot of bench strength, we like to think, and really big company experience, which, as we'll get on to talking to with Uruguay, has proved to be absolutely invaluable because as a sort of minnow, we've managed to attract and bring one of the world's largest companies into one of our projects. And that really only comes because the people in Challenger know how the big companies work, know how the industry, you know, rolls, so to speak. But that's our team.
Okay, right. So sub 20 million market cap company,
yes,
with a big idea. You're sitting with a couple of licenses offshore Uruguay.
Yes.
So let's just, and they're quite large. Let's start with Uruguay. So most people won't have invested in companies with assets in Uruguay. So slightly, just north of Buenos Aires, Argentina, and just south of Brazil. Tell us a little bit about doing business there.
It's fantastic. Genuinely, hand on heart, one of the best places I've ever been. And I've done a lot of stuff in a lot of places over the last 25 years. People don't know about Uruguay because it's very small. It's wedged in between Brazil and Argentina. It's 3 million people population. You just don't hear about it. However, in South America, you know, Uruguayans pride themselves on this reputation as being the Switzerland of South America. It's entirely well-governed, entirely transparent, very developed, the highest per capita income in South America, and everything you would expect. All the rich people in South America deposit their money in Uruguayan banks. They have holiday homes there. It's totally westernized, totally developed. The legal system is predictable. You know, the rule of law is predictable. There's a stable democratic government that gets, you know, elections happen. So there's none of the sort of third worldish connotations you think of when you immediately think of, you know, less developed places. And from an oil and gas perspective, the Uruguayans have put in place top tier regime for oil and gas companies. So really low government take, really low taxes, super supportive administration. And really, it's not, you can take my word for it, but it's proven itself in the sense that in the space of the last 3 years, Uruguay has gone from being a place in the oil industry no one has ever heard of to being a place which is fully licensed and where all of the majors are piling in at the moment and making big commitments and planning big work programs. And so, you know, from a the proof is in the pudding, as they say, and but it's a really wonderful place to do business, I must say.
Okay, so you're a small company. You've managed to secure two big blocks, yes, surrounded by the likes of Shell, YPF, and the like, Apache, I think. How did you get those licenses? What were you obliged to do? Or did you have Chevron in the back pocket?
No. Sometimes these things in life are a mixture of timing, foresight, and good luck. And it was a combination of those three things. So what happened was 2016, 2017, the Uruguayans began preparing to license their offshore. They did a lot of work to establish that it's interesting, there's prospects, etc. And they got all ready to do licensing, and they were ready to launch the first licensing round in early 2020, and then along came COVID. And so suddenly the whole world goes into shutdown, and nobody registered to participate in the first bidding round in Uruguay, which was in May of 2020. And I was back in Sydney in Australia in my pajamas, and Randy, our guy, you know, he rang me up and he said, "It's such a shame. It's such a great license and nobody's registering. If only we could organize ourselves in the next 2 weeks and submit a proposal, it would be virtually uncontested and we could pick up a license that in ordinary circumstances, we wouldn't have a chance of getting." So we hustled, we did what a small company does best, which is we worked quick, we were focused, entrepreneurial, we submitted a proposal, and lo and behold, we were awarded the license in May of 2020. And then Uruguay, like everyone else, went into complete lockdown for 2 years. And so the official award of the license didn't happen until August of 2022. And then here is where the good luck part comes. I mean, we'd had the foresight to see that it could be very interesting. But in early 2022, there were a couple of wildcat wells drilled offshore Namibia, one by Total, one by Shell, that resulted in two of the biggest discoveries of the last decade, mega discoveries. And again, people go, well, what has Namibia got to do with Uruguay? Once upon a time, 120 million years ago, when the Earth was one big continent, Uruguay was exactly adjacent to Namibia. And then as the continents pulled apart and the source rock that is producing today's oil was laid down, you know, what is in Uruguay is the same as in Namibia. It's the geological mirror is the best way to explain it. And then 100 million years goes by, the continents move to where they are. So when these discoveries were made in Namibia in January of 2022, it not only established Namibia as a new oil province, it also validated the fact that there's probably the same petroleum systems, the same source rocks over on the other side of the Atlantic. And again, we were the only license holder at that point in time. And in less than 6 months, all the people you mentioned, Shell, YPF, Apache, they all piled in. They all then bid for other blocks in Uruguay, made huge promises of work, and the whole area has exploded. It's gone completely from zero to fully licensed in a year. Lots of work, lots of interest, lots of activity. Did we know that these discoveries would be made in Namibia? Of course not. That's where we got a bit lucky. But we knew that that activity was going to happen. So we took a view, well, let's get out this asset almost as an option. If it works out in Namibia, it'll be good in Uruguay. And in a sense, we've now the beneficiaries of that option paying off. But that's how we came to be there as a small company. You know, good timing and good luck.
Okay. It's probably one of the few things most people remember from school is the continental drift. You're at some point going to have to move into the point of finding stuff or relying on Chevron to do it. So can you explain the Chevron with their big balance sheet? What is the process from now in terms of moving this to a point where it's more than just a, you know, license holder into actually, you know, going out and doing it?
Well, it is. We already moved it beyond that. So what a small company does well is the early stuff. So we got hold of the license, and then over the last 18 months, we did a series of early work items that are within the capability of a small company and within the financial capability of a small company. So we reprocessed 2D seismic. We did AVO analysis of the reprocessed lines. And we established the basic parameters of three large structures, three large prospects, and we were able to establish a high degree of technical robustness, the prospectivity there, multi-billion barrel prospectivity. And then we went out to the market. We brought Chevron in as a farm-in partner. Now, what comes next? The next important step is you have to go and shoot modern 3D seismic over the area. So if you think of 2D seismic as an X-ray, 3D seismic as an MRI, you get a much better image of what is there. And so Chevron, as part of their deal with us, are going to do that as fast as they possibly can. And with a little bit of good luck and planning, that will kick off towards the end of this year, early next year. Okay? And the 3D seismic will take 3 or 4 months to shoot. Then there's a time lag to interpret the results, etc. But the next big sort of event will come when we see what the outcome of that is, which should be about the middle of next year, so a year or so from now. And then after that, Chevron, who will then be the operator of the block, can make a decision. Well, we like what we see so much, we're going to go forward and drill an initial well. And that would probably follow about a year later. So the steps to realizing value, we did the first step. The next step is 3D seismic, which is on the cards now. It's baked into our deal with Chevron. And then depending on the results of the 3D seismic, the final step is an initial exploration well. Then if that comes in, you're into appraisal, development, et cetera, many years down the track.
For sure. Let's just kind of follow the money trail. So in terms of, I know this company's been going a while, but of recent times and of specifically Uruguay focus, yeah, how much money has been put in by the company and the management team, board's management team, to kind of get it through the kind of licensing phase to be able to have a conversation?
Well, if you start this sort of as a new story from when we got into Uruguay, we've probably spent a couple of million bucks on Uruguay so far. In addition to the company and all the other things we have, but say roughly $2 million. The deal with Chevron is they're going to pay us $12.5 million as a sort of entry fee, and they're going to carry us in the cost of the seismic up to $15 million net to us. So roughly speaking, about a $40 million seismic campaign, which Chevron will pay for all of it, including our share. And then if it moves into an initial well, an initial well will probably be somewhere in the order of $80 million to do. And again, the deal with Chevron is they will carry half of our share of that. So they'll pay for half of our share.
So give me that $80 million relates to this. That's not one well.
That is one well. One single.
I know it's deep offshore, but man, that's a big. I've seen that. Oh.
This is what they cost. This is not, you're drilling in 800, 900 feet of water. You're drilling 3,000 meters down below the seabed, using advanced rigs. I mean, $80 million for an exploration well. Don't forget, you're not just trying to get a production going. You're coring, you're logging, you're doing tests as you go. It's about the going rate is about $80 million, and that's all. And so if it were, and let's just round it up to even $100 million to make it simple, Chevron will own 60% of the project. So they would pay $60 million and our share would be 40, of which our deal with Chevron is they would pick up half of our share. So in a theoretical $100 million well, Chevron would pay 80, we'd pay 20, but we're 40%, they're 60%.
Understand the maths. So which is a chunk of change compared to current valuation. So your expectation around the 3D seismic is going to be one, that it's going to come up with the goods as far as the exploration team are concerned, but two, the market understands it enough to kind of improve your current valuation, right?
Yeah.
Because otherwise, raising $20 million is a difficult one. And what are the options there in terms of getting raising the market or just saying, well, actually, Chevron, you have that one.
Well, no, I mean...
Give us the money for that. How do you play it?
First of all, I mean, you can always go and raise money on the market. And presumably, I mean, the history of the market is as you get closer and closer to these events and people are seeing more and more technical certainty, I mean, if you know your share price rises, it's easier to raise money. The other thing everyone seems to overlook is we have retained 40% interest here. We're free to sell another 20% or to farm down in the jargon another 20%. So we could always do a second farm down, and that's completely common in the industry. It's very rare that you see one of these things get to development and you have a single partner or two partners. You know, you see a lot of these big developments, you'll wind up having three or four multinationals, and then the junior who started it all left with a reasonably small but essentially free stake all the way through. So, I mean, that is the most obvious thing. If we get through the 3D seismic and Chevron, you know, decide they want to drill a well, we'd be looking for it to introduce another partner at that point in time. You know, there are lots of ways you can go about financing these things. The main point is we have the technical validation now of, you know, one of the world's largest oil companies will be doing all this work. You know, to go back to where you started that question, there is a reasonably low risk on 3D. You know, we've already seen image, you've already seen what you see on 2D. So I'd say that, you know, there is a chance that you do the 3D and everyone goes, oh, well, this is really not what we thought and that's the end of it. But the overwhelming likelihood is when you do 3D, what you're doing is you're getting better definition of what you already knew from 2D and usually using the 3D as the basis of picking a drilling location. So in our view anyway, there's a pretty high chance that this thing now goes 3D and at least a single exploration well. Once you drill a well, anything can happen. The rocks are the rocks. But, you know, I think at least over the next 2 or 3 years, the path is pretty clear. Something would have to go really off the rails for us not to see it follow seismic and a well.
Right. And which license is this on?
This is called the OFF-1 license.
OFF-1. Okay, right. Yeah.
We have a license, Area of Three, which we still have 100%. That's brand new. That was only issued to us about 3 weeks ago. It is the final license in Uruguay. So with the issue of that to us, the entire offshore of Uruguay is now licensed for the first time in their history. And with Off Three, we're just planning to do sort of press repeat on what we did with Off One. We have a technical work program lined up that will take probably 6 to 9 months to do. That will kick off soon. At the end of that technical program, we will start a formal process to try and find a partner, you know, another Chevron or similar, and, you know, roll that forward. The only difference with Off 3 is that already has 3D seismic from a decade ago. So you don't need to reshoot it there. You just need to reprocess it. And that kind of cuts a few years out of the cycle till when you get to an initial well. So,
right, you know, okay.
There is a view of life that says Challenger Energy as a corporate entity come 2027, which is in oil speak, not long at all, will have two blocks in Uruguay, each of which will have a well happening at roughly the same time. That would be quite an amazing outcome for a little company.
That'd be great for a little company. Probably wouldn't be such a little company if that happens.
But yes.
Let's look at the flip side of that one in terms of risk management and expectation, etc. Let's say Off One first hole doesn't hit, but you have managed to kind of flip off another 20% on top of the 60% to basically, I guess, presumably fund the advancement of Off Three. Yeah. If you can get another partner in, like Chevron, or even Chevron, who knows, to come and look at that, if they go through the same process, let's say Off One doesn't hit, you've got a second chance with Off Three, because I'm trying to work out how you manage your money and your contribution for Off One if first hole doesn't quite hit or isn't, for whatever reason, stuff goes wrong, right? You know, we've seen it offshore Africa.
It all depends on the mode of failure. Okay, so, you know, First of all, let's start with this this statement. This is not investment for the faint-hearted, okay? Oil and gas exploration is high risk, high return. You know, there is a chance you drill a well, there's nothing there, and you dust your hands of it all and you lose everything. But there is a chance you drill a well like happened in Namibia and you find multi-billion barrel oil fields and then you're 100-for-1 on the investment, you know? So people need to bear that in mind. If, you know, if it fits in a portfolio, I guess, as a high risk, high reward proposition. Back to your question, what is the, you always have to look at what the mode of failure is. If you think of the North Sea in offshore the UK, right? Probably 24 exploration wells were drilled before they actually figured it out and worked out how to make it produce. And now it's this giant producing energy region, right? But so, you know, if the well is drilled in area off one and it doesn't come in, what matters is why did it not come in? If it's just a complete duster because the everything you thought you knew about the source rock and the petroleum system is just wrong, well, then it's overs, you know. And yes, we will have another opportunity with off three because it's a completely different geological play and a completely different setting. But it could be that you drill off one and you see all the evidence of the source rock and the you know, working petroleum system, but the trap, the seal has been breached. And so the oil that you thought might accumulate is not there. Well, it could be elsewhere on the license. There are more than one prospects. There's you know, so far we've identified three very sizable prospects. So you then again have more opportunities. And the reason why you bring in a company like Chevron as your partner is they are not scared of that. That's their business. A little company like us, we could beg, borrow, and steal and maybe get together the wherewithal to be able to drill a single well. And then you're betting everything on one well. Chevron, you look at what they've done in one of their blocks in Namibia. They made a decent find. They now have just immediately said, right, we're going to drill 9 wells, one after the other, and see what happens. You know, they can handle 80 million times 9 in a way that a small company can't. So, you know, the point being that high risk, high reward, but lots of opportunities, and the right partner means you get to go after as many of those opportunities as possible. And, you know, and ultimately you hope to see a success at the end of it all.
Well, but you're carried to a point, right?
Yes.
So when you say you get to go after as many of these as they can stomach, but how do you finance your contribution?
Well, you either then keep getting diluted. Your interest becomes smaller and smaller as they pick up more and more of it, or you have to get innovative. You have to find other people who want to participate. You know, there are other forms of financing you can do, but this is what I've done for a living, you know, finding innovative financial solutions from a small company point of view. But ultimately, what you want is you want some modicum of success because that, you know, opens the door to opportunities. Then other people might be interested. The money markets are more interested. You know, the equity markets look at you differently. So, you know, but you know, those are imminently solvable problems as you progress these assets technically.
Okay, there's such thing as technical success, and then there's commercial success,
yes.
Right? So I'm interested in when it's technical success, it means there's still something to work with. It's better than failure, right?
Yeah.
But commercial success is obviously you knock it out of the park. As you say, high risk, high return, brilliant. Everyone's happy at that point. With things which are sort of technical successes, you've mentioned you've got to find creative ways, alternative financing to get these things. You mentioned a couple of them in terms of getting like the likes of Chevron and maybe A and other down on off three. But you've been around the block, you've worked a few things out. For those potential shareholders or shareholders worried about dilution, what are the alternative kind of non-dilutory options available to you?
Well, I mean, there's always the option to sell. You know, you have to know where you stand, right? As a small company, you have to always be acutely aware of what you can bring to the table and what you can't bring to the table. And if you get into a situation where, you know, your interest is 10, 15% and your partner, who's got a lot more money than you, is, you know, gung-ho on drilling a bunch of wells, Well, they'd only be doing that because they think there's something there. And if you can't keep up with them, that's a perfectly respectable time to exit. And, you know, there are plenty of people who'll buy your interest in these projects. So that's, again, just a standard part of the oil industry and a standard part of what small companies do and a very standard part of what I've done in my career. You know, you start with these assets, you take them to a certain point, but always remain acutely aware of who you are in the food chain. And when you get to a point where you're unable to keep up or you're unable to match your partners, well, you know, cash in. Take your chips, cash it in and pay a big dividend to your shareholders or reinvest it in the next Uruguay or, you know, or whatever. But so again, you know, that's not so innovative to say, well, at this point we exit. But, you know, I say, as I said right at the beginning, I come from a background in private equity. You know, I'm not romantically attached to any of our assets. I'm not romantically, you know, determined to be the guy who found the next biggest oil field in the world. I'm about trying to deliver a solid, you know, good return to shareholders within the framework of high risk, high reward. And if there comes a point in time where the right thing to do is to sell, you sell. Other alternative forms of finance, there are plenty of service companies that will do work, you know, work for equity type deals. You know, the seismic companies will often shoot the seismic and you don't have to pay them nearly anything close to rack rate, but you do a sort of a deal where you can pay them out of a successful discovery. So kind of deals with service providers is another form of, I guess you could call innovative financing. There are a lot of, you know, once you get into the more project-driven stuff where you're actually buying big chunks of kit or doing big chunks of work, you can do a lot of project-type financing, which is different to equity. You get to a point where you can also get debt financing in place. So, you know, it just depends where the project is, what its merits are at that point in time. But there's always more than one way to skin the money cat. And like I say, it's our job to kind of constantly be looking at those and trying to figure out what's the best opportunity, alternative at that point in time.
Gonna get one of those money cats. Okay, let's just help people understand sort of the time frame. You talked about maybe end of this year, beginning of next, in terms of Chevron, what doing the 3D? Is that right, or are you saying yes? Is that right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. And then how quickly after that decisions get made about drilling hole number one? Because it's a big decision. It's an $80 to $100 million.
Well, I can give you
decision,
an exact date. The way licenses are structured is you have an expiration period, a first expiration period. Our first expiration period expires August of 2026. Okay. So by August of 2026, Chevron as the operator will have had to have made a decision on drilling a well in order to apply for a renewal into a second expiration period. And so it cannot possibly be later than then. It usually will be 3-4 months before because there's a lot of paperwork and stuff that needs to be done. So in terms of timeline, seismic towards the end of this year, interpretation of the seismic through the first half of next year, results from the seismic towards the end of next year, which paves the way for a decision on a well in the first half, say, of 2026, so that you can renew the license August of 2026.
That's good. I like that. You kind of got a short window. I kind of wish mining was a bit more like that.
Yes.
People sort of seem to sit in these licenses for decades. That's brilliant. Okay. So what does that mean for people investing, investors in your company and people investing in your company? Before we get there, what's the kind of the retail percentage holding on your share register?
About 30%. So about 30%. I own about 10% of the company. Well, I own about 6% of the company as shares, and I have options over another 3% or so. So I'm sort of roughly 10%. There's a group, probably about 10 shareholders, largely very successful resource investors I know from the past, from Australia and elsewhere, who between them speak for probably about 50% of the company, and the rest is free float, etc. on the AIM.
Right. So how? Well, I guess liquidity is not really an issue.
Yeah.
For you in that sense, is that right?
Yeah, well, we're not super liquid. It's actually quite hard. If someone wanted to buy a really big position in the company, it would actually be quite hard because there's not a huge
amount. Well, that's what I mean. It's not a problem available. For you.
Yeah, correct. Correct. So,
But how do your shares react if some retail dudes decide to like sell down? Does that affect you?
It does short term. I mean, a lot depends on what people are looking for in investment. So, you know, if what you're looking for is a really high grade frontier exploration play and you're prepared to sit there for the next 2 or 3 years and, you know, follow the progress, you know, it'll either be great or it won't be, but that's, you know, that's what I might call intrinsic value creation. There's also all the market shenanigans that go on, and there's bulletin boards and chat boards, and someone starts a rumor and today it's up and tomorrow it's down. And I generally try not to pay any attention to that. The one thing I will say is that the history of these things, firstly, as we stand today, it is just chronically undervalued. And you would assume that I, as the CEO, will tell you that. But you can actually, I mean, all the analysts have done it. You can take the metrics of our farm out deal with Chevron and actually just work out what that means in a per share value. And that on its own is worth 4 times our current share price, right? So for whatever reason, the equity markets are not accepting that, not yet across it, not yet willing to bake it into the share price. I don't know why, but, you know, just on pure sort of analytics, it's undervalued. And in a market sense, what tends to happen is as you get closer and closer to catalyst events, such as the drilling, such as 3D seismic and then drilling and then, you know, a block renewal, whatever these milestone events are, you tend to see the share price kind of go up and then respond to that event. So if what you are is an investor who's interested in sort of playing the market, as it were, there's a lot of opportunities to do that. That's not my favorite kind of investor, but that is people out there. What I'm interested in is building value, core value in these assets over time. There's a program. It'll take 3 or 4 years to see the outcome of that program. And, you know, over that time, my job and my promise to investors is to always keep the costs low, always to treat shareholder money like it's my own, because it is my own. And, and to do high quality technical work and to do what we say we're going to do, to deliver what we promise we're going to deliver. The rest will take care of itself.